This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 192, Even the Devil Believes. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Will Wynn. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including a possible grittier future for Star Trek on television, and a guide that will help you get ready for your visit to Vulcan. Then in the feature, we're joined by Mike Morrison of Metatrex and Trek Film Associate Producer Ken Tripp to discuss the DS9 episode, In the Hands of the Prophets. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Will. It's great to have you back here with me on The Ready Room, the first time you've co-hosted in quite a while. How's everything going there on the NX-01?
It's going well. The audience can't see, but you're wearing a matching hat of mine, Chris. You're wearing the NX-02 Columbia hat. I love the NX-02, so you're showing your boomer side, so that's really great to see.
Exactly. And for those who are listening who don't know, Will co-hosts our Enterprise show called Warp 5 every week and talks about the 22nd century, but today we're going to rope you in to talk about the 24th. Or maybe other centuries, because we're going to talk a little bit about possible future directions for the franchise on television, which could explore kind of any point in time, right?
Pretty much. I mean, I really feel like there should be a Star Trek movie that goes back to like 2002 with MySpace and really incorporate that early social media into a Star Trek story, because, you know, why not?
That would be funny. Maybe it's a sitcom set at a Federation office. But they are, well, it wouldn't be a Federation office. It would be sort of like a Earth Space Probe Agency office, maybe. And they're still using things like Twitter and Facebook and all. And we just see what life's like for the 12 people who work there in the office.
I could just see Dwight Schrute right in a Starfleet uniform. It writes itself.
Really. I can see him like being upset, you know, about, gosh, my colleagues keep putting my tricorder in Jell-O. All right.
Yep, exactly.
Well, let's go into the first story here. And this is not about the new series that's coming out in 2017.
Shocking, I know.
Yeah, I mean, we did a whole show on that just two shows ago, so you can go listen to our discussion there with Larry Nemechek. But this is about a comment that Paramount's Motion Picture Group president, Mark Evan, made in an interview that he did with Wired recently. And they were speculating on various things, and Star Trek, of course, comes up. And he says, and this is important, actually, his quote's important because it's a little bit different from the headlines that we've been seeing. He said, like, I'll be ridiculous with you, but what would Star Trek Zero Dark Thirty look like? Where is the SEAL Team 6 of the Star Trek universe? That fascinates me. The headlines I've been seeing for this story have been more like, where's the SEAL Team 6? Like people were upset that somehow it wasn't being incorporated into Star Trek. And of course, we had the Makos on Enterprise, so we have had this element before. I think what Mark Evan is saying here is just he's speculating on, like, what if we did this? What could we do with it? Would it be interesting? And so I wanted to ask you, Will, would you be interested in a Star Trek series that really focused on that element of Starfleet?
Yes and no. I'm really torn about this because he does preface it with saying, let me be ridiculous and say, what does a SEAL Team 6 look like in the Star Trek universe? On the one hand, I really like the fact that he's saying there's a larger world out there. There's a larger world outside of the Enterprise or one ship and what have you. And I think that's a great instinct because that's where media is going to right now. Marvel Universe, Star Wars Universe being the two prime examples of expanding that universe out. Rogue One, a great example of expanding the story base. So I think that's a really good instinct because there's a lot to talk about in the Star Trek universe. Now, does it necessarily have to be SEAL Team 6? Now, don't get me wrong, Zero Dark Thirty was a great movie. Those types of special operations, those types of movies have a place. They have a huge place in Hollywood. Call of Duty, obviously huge in video game circles. So I understand why that would be something that the studio would kind of take a look at. Like, what would that look like? My hesitance is just that's something that's so big in so many other franchises or properties. Does it really have to have a Star Trek veneer on it, considering, you know, the Into Darkness, considering movies we've gone before? Like, do we really need to see that? I mean, yes, it does exist, but if you're really going to expand the universe, how about we go somewhere else that makes it more uniquely Star Trek? So it's not just an action-adventure show, although it is an action-adventure show in part. It's not what it's solely about. So we have Makos. We've seen that. We've seen all these things before. So, and we've seen Section 31. I get the Black Ops stuff, but it can be a piece of it. It could be something that we can definitely explore. I don't want to rule that out completely. But at the same time, if they're going to branch out into other directions, I hope they branch out into, I'd love to see civilian life. That's one thing that Star Trek hasn't really shown in sustained great detail, but I think there is such an opportunity to tell a non-Starfleet story. And some people might say, oh, that's going to be too boring. Who cares? I think if it's written well enough, it has a really important hook that, what does life look like in this future? Like, what does it look like outside of these spaceships? And I think if the right writers, you can tell really great stories that are not necessarily boring, but just very different.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, I'm not personally that interested in the military aspect or the special operations aspect or the combat aspect of Star Trek. The big battles like we get on Deep Space Nine during the Dominion War, those are cool. Matthew and I talked on The Orb last show, though, about how ridiculous the idea of two giant fleets meeting each other head on in the middle of space is.
Just like,
you know, like it makes no sense, right? But it's cool to watch. But I'm not personally interested in a series that would be like Zero Dark Thirty, SEAL Team 6 type storylines within Star Trek. I do think that there are a lot of people in the fan base, though, who would find that really, really interesting. In the show, two shows ago, when Larry Nemechek and I talked about the new series and the format that it might take, one thing that we talked about was, because it's being made for streaming only, will it be sort of a traditional model of 20, well, for Star Trek, 26 episodes, but for more recent television, say 22 episodes, or will it be more of the streaming model where we get like 12 episodes? And one thing that we considered was the idea of doing a series where every season tells a completely different story. It's not seven seasons of the same characters all the way through. So if you did something like that, I think you could take an idea like this and make it one of the seasons. Or maybe we just do shorter series. Maybe we do series where you have three or four seasons with 12 episodes per season, and then you do another Star Trek series, kind of like Disney is going to do all these standalone movies for Star Wars, which I'm very skeptical about personally, but they're trying to fill in the Star Wars universe by telling all these different stories that don't have to be locked into the format of one movie.
Are you saying you don't want to see a young Watto story, Chris? You don't want to see that being a trilogy?
My son said he wants to see a young Yoda story. Of course, I told him.
Of course, because of course they're going to do a young Yoda story. Of course.
But if you do a young Yoda story, you've got to go back. So he's really young. You've got to go back, what, like 500 years or more?
Like old, old Republic.
It's the old, old Republic. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
And anyway, you know, I think that's an interesting idea, though, what they're doing. And with Star Trek, you could do these smaller series, and then you could do more series more often, and you could fill in all of these gaps. And so if they do a series, which is really about special operations, and it doesn't connect with me on the same level as some of the other Star Trek series have in the past, they may do another series that's just exactly what I want to see, that's very character-driven. Or like you said, maybe it focuses on civilian life. What's life like on Earth in the 23rd century to the 24th century? That would be interesting. So
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, the possibilities with this new model of streaming, digital only, CBS owns the license for the property. They can create the material and they own the distribution channel as well. And it's not dependent on Nielsen ratings and advertisers in the way that it has been in the past. There are great possibilities of what they can do. And so, yeah, maybe go this direction for some content. But I would not want this to be the only Star Trek series that I have access to for the next 7 years. That would really disappoint me.
Yeah, I agree. I think the anthology format is my hope and dream. Like when I heard there's going to be a Star Trek series, I was like, please let it be an anthology. Please let it be like, you know, what's being done with Marvel right now, where they just release one season of Daredevil and they're going to release Jessica Jones, or they're just going to release these really tightly plotted story arcs, but then another season may take it in a new trajectory and they may overlap. They may have some sort of convergence, but have it really embrace the fact that this is a larger Star Trek universe. So in that regard, I think the Paramount executive has it right on the money. They should really embrace the fact that this is tell a story one season on one starship, and the next season on a planet, and then another starship, and then they meet together. There's overlap. I mean, it works perfectly.
Yeah, I think it would be wonderful. So we'll see where it goes. And of course, I don't think anything like this is going to happen quickly. I don't think the next series is going to be based on special ops or anything like that. So this is more down the road, but it's a great way to breathe life into the franchise, right? And make it more dynamic moving forward. All right. Well, the other thing we want to talk about in news today is a new book from our friend Dayton Ward, a great friend of the network and frequent guest on Literary Treks. It's not a novel this time. It's one of these travel guides. This one's Hidden Universe, Star Trek, a travel guide to Vulcan. So it's literally your guidebook to go to Vulcan. The synopsis says, plan your next trip to the planet Vulcan with Hidden Universe, Star Trek, a travel guide to Vulcan. Find restaurants that serve the best fried sandworms in Vulcan port. Take a trip to the Fire Plains or experience spring break at the Voroth Sea. Learn all about the native Vulcan people and their unusual customs. Discover how to correctly perform the traditional Vulcan salutation. You really don't want to get this wrong. Learn key Vulcan phrases such as Namtor Puyan Tvi Shal Wilat. Where is your restroom? Remember that, Will. You're going to need that.
That was really good pronunciation, by the way, everyone. I feel like you really have Vulcan blood inside you, Chris.
Maybe. I just watched that scene from The Wrath of Khan with Spock and Savick over and over and over.
It's so good.
It's one of the only times we get to hear Vulcan. Anyway, it continues. Find out what to do if you suddenly find yourself host to a Katra, a Vulcan's living spirit, at an inconvenient moment. All this and more can be found within the pages of this essential travel guide to one of the most popular and logical destinations in the known universe. So, I know there was something like this for Vulcan a while back. Maybe it was How to Speak Klingon, maybe, that was giving you tips on things like finding the restroom and so forth. But this is an actual travel guide. If they expand this and they do it for other worlds in Star Trek, what's at the top of your list, Will, for travel guides that you'd like to have?
I would love to see Cardassia, although I would imagine the Cardassian travel guide be very depressing and very status and very just like, you're going to eat here because that's where good, loyal patriots eat that serve Cardassia. I love this concept, but I would love to see Andoria, and obviously I'm sure Kronos is going to be one, teller and... you know, the entire gamut of all the planets that are out there. But I think Andor, I think Kronos would be on the top of my list. But I really think I love the fact that we still seem to be in this nonfiction renaissance of Star Trek books, where we're developing these books that's kind of in universe, kind of has a unique spin on things, like Stellar Cartography and like some of the other books. I think it's great.
Yeah, it would be cool. I would also, of course, like to see one for Bajor, as we're going to talk about today.
Bajor, obviously, yeah. Duh, yeah.
Well, we're going to talk about in the feature today many aspects of Bajor, and it's one of those cultures that plays such a prominent role in Star Trek, and it's fleshed out a lot more. I mean, like Vulcan got fleshed out on Enterprise in the fourth season. Prior to that, one of the most important cultures in Star Trek, and we knew almost nothing about what the planet itself was like or the civilization there was like. And Bajor is one of those two where there's so much they could explore. And Cardassia is a great pick because the Cardassians, I think, are one of the most well-developed alien races in Star Trek, thanks to DS9 and their pivotal role there. But that would be fascinating as well.
I think the Romulus travel guide would just be like, our planet explodes, so what's going to happen?
Come here while you can, right?
Come here while you can. Yeah.
And of course, the one for Ferenginar would be filled with tips about how to deal with the rain.
That's true. All the rules of acquisition. I mean, it's good stuff.
I wonder what the section on tipping on Ferenginar would be like. It's got to be really complex.
Yeah, I feel like it's either be really complex or be considered like a capital offense. Like, how dare you like tip the lower classes? Like, that's some sort of something that...
So you think the owners of the establishments would be offended that you tipped the people working there?
They would maybe be offended, or maybe they rely on off-worlders to tip them because they don't pay them anything. So, well, like, if you want to see our servers, you know, not starve, then you should probably, you know, tip them because we're not going to pay them anything.
Yeah, see, tipping is very interesting to me because we don't tip in Japan. That's culturally not something that you do here. But like you said, in the States, restaurant owners depend on the customers to subsidize their employees by tipping so that they don't have to actually pay them a decent wage. And I feel like on Ferenginar, that's what people like Quark would do, right? Because that way they get to keep more of the profits for themselves, so... Yeah. Well, this is cool. I'm interested to see if this is going to become a series of books where they do many of them. And I think they picked a great person to write it in Dayton for the Vulcan one. And it's going to be available on July 26th of 2016. So you've got a little ways to go. But, you know, perfect for summer. Although, again, I'm not sure if summer is the best time to visit Vulcan. It's probably really hot.
It would be literally... probably not survivable for a human.
Right.
Summer on Vulcan. You would definitely need... What was the thing in Enterprise where T'Pol has evolved like an inner eyelid?
Yeah, Vulcans have inner eyelids to protect their eyes from the sun, yeah.
She doesn't need to drink water for like a week. She's like, don't worry about it. I'm okay. Like, that's crazy. So it's... during summertime, you would be dead in 30 seconds. Yeah.
But it does make sense for the Vulcans to develop an inner eyelid in that environment and be able to go a long time without water. So, yeah, I can see that this book is probably bundled with some prosthetic inner eyelids that you can put on while you're there.
Warning, children, do not actually put this in your eye or swallow it or do anything with it because that's just dangerous.
Exactly. So, I'm not sure where all this is going to be available. It's going to be a hardcover book, as I understand it. It's available for pre-order right now for $13.24 on Amazon. All right. Well, those are the two items that we have in news today. We would like to remind everyone before we go into the feature that The Ready Room is just one of many, many shows that we have here on the network. We have one or two new shows every single day for you, talking about every aspect of the Star Trek universe. In fact, here's a quick look at some of those other things we've been discussing on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
They just happen to come at just the right time.
Right,
or just the right time
for it to be dangerous.
Like, literally, like, not even, like, that day, but, like 2 minutes before this happens.
Earl Grey.
Well, it does all those cloak experiments. It deployed that communications array.
Minefield?
And the minefield for exploratory purposes.
Let's not talk about the Defiant, because you know it's just going to upset me.
The Ready Room.
here's one more thing I want to throw out here for you guys. Recasting this episode, because I know you guys like to do this on To the Journey with things, with series and such. I think that Ma'ab should be played by Will Ferrell.
To the Journey!
Okay, I know Tristan's going to pick that one, and he's going to pick that one, so I'm going to pick this one.
Yeah, this one has a really nice Balana moment, so I'm going to leave that one for Tristan.
Right, like, and of course you pick it every time, and I know I can rely on you.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Now I feel like I have to see The Wicker Man to get all of the jokes that are in this movie.
Which one, the original or the remake?
Why would I watch anything with Nicolas Cage?
The 602 Club.
I remember hearing Timothy Zahn, even back then, reading an article that he was listening to the John Williams scores in his car as he was thinking all this through and making sure the pacing felt like it did with the music. So maybe it had to do with the certain music he was listening to. Maybe he was listening to a New Hope score at that point. I don't know.
Literary Treks.
I think we had between the three of us half a dozen or eight different springboards, and they were written in such a way that they could have gone to either ship and crew. It was like, you know, the Sagittarius encounters big blob in space, or Endeavor encounters derelict spacecraft, or I mean, I'm being real surface here. I mean, the prompts we provided in the Bible were probably just a couple of sentences long, and it was just meant to say these are the kinds of stories we're thinking about.
Women at Warp.
So we went in and pitched, and I have to say that was one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. I have scrubbed in on brain surgery. It did not frighten me as much as waiting outside Gene Roddenberry's office getting ready to go in and pitch to him.
Meta Treks.
That would have just been a grand moment if, you know, George Takei would have played Tuvix, you know, and when the transporter accident happens, he's standing there in those colorful clothes and just says, oh my.
Oh my.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what else we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can get our shows everywhere that you get your podcasts, whether you're an iOS user or you're an Android user, Windows Phone, BlackBerry. We're everywhere. In iTunes, we are a featured provider with Apple, so you can go to itunes.com/trekfm, and that'll take you straight to our artist section. And we really thank Apple for their support there. And in fact, the past week, as we're recording this, we've been the featured network in the iTunes store this week on Trek FM on the front page of the podcast section. And that's been really wonderful for getting more exposure for our Star Trek podcast to everyone. So we thank everyone listening for your support of the shows as well, because without your support, Apple never would have made us a feature provider in the first place. So thanks so much for that. And again, if you're not an Apple user, you can go to our website. You can stream from the pages there. You can download MP3 files or go to SoundCloud. You can play things there also. We're also in TuneIn, Stitcher, Windows Phone Directory, and coming up later on down the road, we'll be in the Google Play Store as well. We're already set up in there. Google has not announced yet when they're going to open up podcasts to the public to consume, but right now they're inviting everyone in to set up. So thanks so much for that. All right, Will. Well, let's go ahead and bring in Mike and Ken and talk about Deep Space Nine. At the end of its first season, Deep Space Nine really began to take on the form that would define the series. The writers wanted to follow up the powerful duet with something even better and even more layered. And to do this, they brought together the Federation's scientific approach to the world and the Bajorans' religious one. The clash of philosophies tells us a lot about our own world as well as Gene Roddenberry's vision for Star Trek. And today we're going to talk about the season one finale, In the Hands of the Prophets. And to help us do that, we're joined by Mike Morrison, co-host of our philosophy podcast, Meta Treks. Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Great to have you back here on The Ready Room. And also joining us for the first time on The Ready Room is Network Associate Producer Ken Tripp. Welcome, Ken.
Thanks for having me.
We're glad you're here. We're glad you opened up the Orb of Audio. and you're here with us today. All right, guys. So let's start off, as we always do, with a little synopsis of the episode for those who have not seen it. Keiko O'Brien has opened a school in the station, which most Niners know, and she's teaching the kids about the wormhole. Of course, she teaches Federation kids as well as Bajoran kids. And Vedic Wynn, who we all come to know and love, with air quotes there, over the course of the series, walks into the classroom. She's very upset that Keiko is teaching a scientific approach and not a spiritual approach to the wormhole. This creates a real clash of philosophies, as I said in my intro, aboard the station involving Wynn and Keiko and Sisko and Kira. And it all plays out in a very interesting way to talk about how the Federation sees the world and how the Bajorans see the world. And it parallels a lot of our own world and what we see, you know, happening both at the time DS9 first aired and even today. Well, along the way, Wynn refuses to budge and actually hatches a plot to not only shut down the school, but also to assassinate Vedic Barayal, who could become Kai, and she does not want him to be because they are from rival, they have rival views of where the Bajoran religion should go. So at the end of the day, Wynn goes back to Bajor, tail tucked between her legs, I guess I would say, since her plot did not work, and she's pretty much made an enemy of Sisko at this point. But things go on as they do on Deep Space Nine for everyone after this. And, of course, the writers build upon this storyline throughout the series. So that's the basic synopsis. So let's talk about our initial thoughts here. Mike, why don't you kick us off with your first thoughts on In the Hands of the Prophets?
Yeah, thanks for having me on the Ready Room again. You know, the philosopher and the theologian in me really latches onto the concepts of this episode. It's a great commentary, albeit I think a little obvious commentary regarding the philosophical question of science versus religion. One of the things that really draws me personally to DS9 as a series is that it seems to be somewhat of a departure from what's considered by some to be the orthodox Star Trek, which tends to lean towards scientific naturalism. It strikes a really good balance here that allows an exploration of spirituality in the life of its characters. And I want to emphasize spirituality because I think there's a separation between spirituality and religion. And what we're really exploring here, especially in the life of Kira Nerys, is her spirituality, not necessarily her religion. Mm-hmm. So as a fan, I find that really appealing. Beyond that, this episode kind of has it all. It's got political intrigue. It's got the makings of a good murder mystery. And you know, one of the things that I want to draw attention to is how well written this episode is. It's really heavy dialogue that's very deliberate. And to me, the best Star Trek is always built around a strong script that examines, you know, ideas and explores the human condition. And this particular episode, I think, does it really well. So I'm looking forward to the discussion today.
Yeah. I'm glad you bring up the difference between spirituality and religion. And I would also throw faith in there as well. It's something that Matthew and I talk about often on The Orb. And it's a very important distinction. And we'll talk about it more along the way here. So, Ken, how about you? What are your initial thoughts?
Well, what I really liked about this episode is it brought everything full circle for the first season. So they started off with a very powerful spiritual episode, I would say, with the emissary. And then they bookended it perfectly with this one. So I like the fact that they opened this door. I thought it was gutsy at the time for a show to do that. And it's not gutsy in the Star Trek world, so to speak, but to tackle these issues, I give them a lot of credit for doing that. When I got caught up into the spiritual, or let's say religious versus creationist arguments in the beginning, one of the things that really struck me in my rewatch was the passion and the anger. So there was a lot of good dialogue, but there was a lot of visceral responses. You know, I thought that Keiko looked very mad through the whole thing.
Well, Keiko, you know, she's like that with Miles about things like picking up his socks and things too. So
I really feel bad for her. She is just not well liked. But you know, that was even when they had the conference not too long after they came together, the discussion in Cisco's office, again, a lot of anger. And I find that so, well, one, refreshing for Star Trek because everybody's always cool and collected. But in this show, this demonstrates the passion, I think, that Star Trek could lack at times when getting into these episodes. So for me, I was hopeful that the episode would continue that dialogue. And when it kind of shifted and it became more of a political whodunit type thing, that whole argument kind of got negated a bit because, you know, it was set up from the beginning by Wynn. So I enjoyed it, but there were aspects of it I really would have loved to see them tackle further and a little bit more in depth, because it ended very, you know, very quickly. And then it was on to season two. It never really was revisited to that extreme again.
Right. How about you, Will?
Yeah, I think Mike and Ken both bring up really great points, and it shows the wider universe that's possible with Deep Space Nine. I think it's interesting with this episode because it's a nexus of both spirituality, religion, and as mentioned before, there's politics as well. Because in a lot of ways, how the Bajoran religion here is portrayed, especially with the introduction of Vedic Wynn, it's very reminiscent of medieval Catholic Church. It was very, very reminiscent of an earlier form of Catholicism.
Well, it's based on very early Catholic Church.
Exactly.
Well,
one that is very enmeshed in political machinations, one that has an interest in politics and temporal affairs. And you could see that type of manipulations, that type of behind the scenes movement. And I think it's really interesting because it's the interplay of all these things. And I think Ken actually brings up a really good point of how it introduces these concepts, but unfortunately we don't see it later down the road. Obviously other storylines kind of pop in, but it'd be really interesting to see down the road a further development of what does it mean to be religious in the Bajoran faith? What is the orthodoxy? Are there different types of interpretations? Are there different types of sects, different types of readings of scripture? And I think that gets lost down the road because it just becomes more of a monolithic interpretation of the Bajoran religion. And then you have the Paul Rates later on. And, you know, it's juggling a lot. So I don't necessarily begrudge the show that much, but it definitely raises some interesting questions, but we don't necessarily see the conclusion to it. But overall, I think it shows you what DS9 can become.
Yeah, I think those are all really good points. And I mentioned early Catholic Church. It's more like you said, medieval. It's 15th, 16th century range is kind of what they were going for here.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting contrast, right, between a civilization that is not only a spacefaring civilization like the Federation, but has been a spacefaring civilization for maybe 1,000 years, right, before the Federation encounters them, and that they still have that structure going on. I also think that having this religious basis for the Bajorans and where people like Wynn are trying to take them following the occupation is interesting too, because what we see in our own world is that when times get tough, religion tends to strengthen its hold on people. And we see that today actually in the world. Mm-hmm. As far as how this plays into my initial thoughts on how it plays into the series, is like Ken pointed out, they had the very spiritual story in Emissary to start, and then they told a lot of stories that were very much like TNG stories through season one. And then at the end, with Duet and with this episode, they returned more to the type of deeper story that they were telling in Emissary, and it set the tone for the rest of the series. And they don't go straight into it moving into season two. Not every episode in season two has that DS9 flavor that we think of, but certainly opening with the Circle Trilogy and going further, they do pick up on this, and so it is very important in that respect. So continuing to talk about setting the tone, just picking up on what I'm saying here, Mike, what do you think about the platform that this episode gave the writers to really make DS9 a different show, to come out of the shadow of TNG?
I think it very much draws a contrast, and I really never thought of these two episodes, Duet and In the Hands of the Prophets, as being connected in any way. The interesting thing is that they do seem to be building towards a reckoning between the past and the future of the Bajoran people. You know, we go into season two from here and right into the Circle trilogy, where we're dealing with, you know, still some of those scars from 50 years of occupation, and how are these different sects of Bajorans dealing with that? We see that in Duet. We see that in Hands of the Prophets, where we're, you know, we're now exploring the religious aspect of it. We go into the Circles trilogy. So there's a reckoning between the past and the future of these people. And it really does set the tone. It really sets the course, if you will, of where they're going as a people.
Well, I agree with what Mike is saying, and I think one of the things that this does is it launches the whole, intrigue with, was it Vedic Wynn right now?
Yeah, she's a Vedic at this point.
Vedic Wynn.
Yeah, yeah.
So when I was trying to remember when I was watching this series and rewatched it with my daughter about, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, that, they really could have focused a lot more on the spirituality, and they could have had their own version of the Scopes trial or something along those lines, you know,
they kind of do.
The space station.
I mean, that's kind sort of, that's what they're paralleling here. So they kind of do have their own version of the Scopes trial.
Right. And then it became a way for them to launch the whole Vedic Wynn, Kai Wynn, okay, here's a very evil player that's going to come back and is, you know, going to really change the face and the direction of the show in many ways. So if you were to stop watching, I think after this episode, you'd say, okay, they kind of cheated. They just ended this thing. And why? They had such a great subject matter. But if you hang in there, you realize this was a pivotal point in the show and where it was going to go long term.
You know, one thing that's interesting there is that when she's talking to Sisko, she says that Kaiopaka told her you should never look into the eyes of your own gods. And she says that she disagreed, that she said, I would do anything to look into their eyes. And for this to be the first appearance of her, and knowing what she does by the end of the series to achieve that goal is amazing.
That's true. And when she first arrived, she was very calm. Her demeanor, she was willing to compromise. She almost came off as just somebody who really just believed in what she did and was trying to work, and Keiko wasn't biting at all. She was just more and more angry. And now you saw the true colors after a while. So I thought her character was very well played, because it wouldn't be somebody you would initially dislike. You would just say, okay, they fervent believe in what they believe. Mm-hmm. And she came off not so bad in the beginning.
Well, do you think she was willing to compromise here? That's an interesting point, because I think she's very passive-aggressive here. She's not really willing to compromise. She's telling Keiko that, you know, it's fine if you... I'm not going to ask you to avoid teaching the wormhole from a scientific perspective. I just don't want you to teach about the wormhole at all. So let's So it's not really a compromise. Like, a compromise would be, let's present both sides of the argument. But even if Keiko had said, okay, I will teach both sides, Wynn would not have accepted that, because Wynn is not going to accept the scientific side of being taught at all.
Yeah, and I guess where I was going is, from the very beginning, it had nothing to do with what Keiko was teaching. It was a method to an end. She was using this to bring...
Burrell to the station.
Yeah, bring Burrell to the station. That's all it was. So yeah. The whole thing wound up being... But then that's what kind of bugged me a little bit. From the very beginning, it was staged and plotted. It was not a true, because we don't know how she truly feels about what's taught in the classroom. It was just a method, and that's kind of too bad.
I think that's a really good point, Ken, is that it was a bait and switch in terms of it being part of a methodology. It was just tactics to get Brah on the station. But I think there is something to be said that there was an undercurrent of a more fundamentalist, a more focused or more narrow-minded interpretation of Bajoran belief, because you had followers that still believed very fervently what Vedic Gwyn said in here, you know, with the vendor not wanting to serve Miles, the Jumja stick. So you had, I think it was illustrated enough that there at least was a school of thought that Vedic Gwyn tapped into. Whether Vedic Gwyn actually believed that is an open question. I think she did. I think she also realized that it served her own ends to have Barile on the station too. But I think the fact that you had a change in opinion, at least in the middle of the episode, where people were actually taking Vedic Gwyn's side and saying, you know what, we don't want to talk to these Starfleet types anymore because they're a danger to our very narrow interpretation of our faith. I think that, for at least for me, was pretty clear.
Yes, you're right. It was definitely a manipulation there, and she did stoke the fire. It's just hard to say. It's like when, it's how any of us behave when people aren't watching. Would these people have been that upset with their kids in that classroom if she never came to the station? It's just hard to say.
No, and I actually saw this character coming for a mile, because it's a credit to Louise Fletcher. She really nails this character. And those that listen to Metatrex knows I've mentioned my background is theology. I've been in Christian ministry for 25 years, and I have seen Vedic Gwyn multitudes of times over the years in positions of authority in the Christian church. And I'm very sad to say that. Very manipulative. There's always a motive behind what, she, in this case, she's doing. And she captures that so well. She's a snake in the grass looking for opportunity, and she plays that so well. So I never saw her from the beginning as being willing to compromise. I saw her as willing to manipulate the situation and use kind of that tongue-in-cheek rhetoric to sway opinion. And again, I've seen that for 25 years that I've been in ministry. She plays that so well.
She really does. You know, I think that she is genuinely bothered by the idea of the Bajoran children being taught that the wormhole is a scientific phenomenon. And she does use it as an opportunity, because, I mean, this is the thing about Wynn, is she is very sharp, right? She always identifies the opportunities that will help her reach her goal of being Kai, and then I don't know, when you get to the end of the series, you almost feel like she wants to be the ruler of Bajor. You know, she's just very, very power hungry, which again is what you see, I think, Mike, what you're talking about with some of the people that you've seen in ministry over the years, that some people are just very power hungry, and whether they use religion to gain that power, or whether they use politics to gain that power, or they use their position in business to gain that power, it's just a personality type, right? And I think often those people, they're using whatever's available to them just to gain personal power and to control others. But I think that she sincerely did not want the children to be taught that.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, I agree. Because it damages the view. If the prophets are simply aliens, right, it calls into question the entire belief system of Bajor. And I think in our own terms, without, you know, pitting any particular religion against another or anything like that, think of what would happen to us if we discovered other life in the universe, and especially if we made contact with other life in the universe. That would have a profound impact on our own worldview of like who we are. And for those who believe that a God did create Earth and created all of us, it could be very difficult to come to terms with. At the same time, it is interesting that different religions on Earth have different views of this. Like some religions are more open to the idea that there is other life in the universe. And of course, you could say that that was all created as well, right? You know, it doesn't have to mean that you are diminished. But it seems in the eyes of the Bajorans anyway, in the eyes of Wynn, that anything that might point to the prophets as being something more than mystical or supernatural or whatever, you know, not scientific, not simply aliens like any of us would be, you know, to the Bajorans, really threatens her.
Yeah, I agree. I think she's very sincere in her belief, but the old saying is, you know, even the devil believes, but she's very sincere in her belief, but definitely uses that belief as a means to manipulate those around her for her own personal gain. You're right, Chris. She's very power hungry, and religion becomes that vehicle for her to grab that power. There's nothing, I think, uglier in the world than politics injected in religion.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, because we see here in this context, it's injected into religion, but it's also injected into the classroom. And when you think about it, here in this context, teaching is political. And that's not necessarily, I'm not making a value judgment on it being political. It's political in the sense that we as a society place value on what is considered knowledge and knowledge that we should pass down to our children, what should be instructed. It becomes an official record of what we believe should be taught. And this is something that we have to agree upon. And at least here in the States, that is an issue that has always been contentious, especially with local control, local boards of education, what can be considered proper curriculum, evolution versus creationism. It is a political issue, what we've done in our prior history. It becomes a political issue. And I think it doesn't necessarily have to be a pejorative, but it definitely adds an angle to which people can definitely have different agendas, definitely can work at odds or work together. But it's something that is illustrated in the classroom that sometimes that people don't realize that it really is a political issue, what we teach to children, what we teach in schools, whether public or private or what have you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Cisco becomes the kind of the balancing act here. You know, when Zachary and I were conceiving Metatrax, we chose a line of dialogue from this episode to be part of our show's opening. You know, Cisco says to Keiko and Kira, you know, my philosophy is that there's room for all philosophies on this station. And to me, that's a very Star Trek point of view. And I think that's the balance that this episode is attempting to strike, because on the one side, you have Keiko O'Brien, purely science. You have Vedic Wynn on the other side, purely religion. And they're the extremes, right? And I know, depending on your personal point of view, you may think that one maybe was more reasonable than the other, but in reality, these are the two extreme points of view. And in the middle of that is Cisco trying to bring a balance to that. And that, again, that's a very Star Trek kind of viewpoint.
What's interesting to me with Cisco's position here is that he's really representing Gene Roddenberry's original concept for Star Trek, which is not always evident in the original series in reality, but it is the original concept, which is that there are many points of view and many angles and many ways of approaching something. And of course, that's what we came to know as IDIC, infinite diversity and infinite combinations within Star Trek. It's interesting to me when I look at fandom that Star Trek fans in general embrace IDIC. That's why we love Star Trek. Yet, when we discuss Star Trek, all you need to do is look at the discussion threads online. You can see that fans don't actually embrace IDIC, right? Their position's right. You know, JJ movies suck. Someone else says, well, I kind of like the JJ movies. You're wrong. They suck. They're the worst thing ever. But there are some good things. They suck. You know, that's the position. That's not IDIC, right? Because you're not even trying to see the other point of view. Whereas here, Cisco is trying to embrace that point of view. He is the champion for Gene Roddenberry's original vision. He has a great conversation with Jake in this episode.
Yes.
Where he explains to Jake, you know, Jake is saying that it's obvious that the prophets are aliens. It's obvious that the wormhole is just a scientific thing. it's dumb to think otherwise. And Sisko tells him, look, it depends on your point of view. You know, maybe for us, it seems that way. For them, it's different. And we have to respect all of these opinions. We don't have to agree with them. But, you know, people are entitled to have different beliefs. So my position in this episode would be that the prophets are aliens and the wormhole is a scientific phenomenon, right? Because I personally am atheist. I don't believe in the religious angle of this. That's my personal belief. But of course, to someone else, maybe the idea that it's just scientific makes no sense. Of course, I respect that opinion. That's their view. They may be right. I may be wrong. I don't know. It's just from my own interpretation of the world that I live in, that's the view that I have come to believe is true. But I'm not going to try to change the mind of the other person. Unless the other person, well, and then I'm not going to try to change their mind, but I respect their opinion unless they try to impose it on someone else, which is what Wynn does in the end here by bombing the school and and getting Neela to be her agent to go and try to assassinate Beryl. That's where in this story it all crosses the line, and where while Keiko and Wynn are both on extremes, Wynn is the one who really crosses the line.
Oh, there's no doubt. I think, too, with Wynn, you could have surmised that she might have not been very religious, spiritual, or believe, because from the very beginning, there was a plot, right? They killed that ensign. And
that's my view of Wynn, by the way, in general.
Yeah.
That's always been my view of Wynn, yeah.
So she was using Neela, and she corrupted her head, and it cost an innocent life. And all that happened, you know, at the same time that the school discussion was going on. So this was plotted out before she got there as to exactly what she was going to do and how to start the confrontation. And that's why I said what I said. She may be very much so, like you guys were saying, I don't want kids learning this or whatever. There's also a part of it where she probably could care less about any of that and just wanted to assume power and deliberately put, you know, opposing point of views together and tried to create chaos, which she was very successful at doing. And in fact, she kind of won because she walked away scot-free. But, you know, when you talk about the different philosophies and the talking back and forth, I thought that one of the things that would be interesting to dive into is they may be a very religious people, the whole race and so forth, in terms of, you know, how they see the wormhole. But from another perspective, they could recognize them as being quote-unquote superior, having abilities they don't understand, and worship that. Not necessarily saying that there's an afterlife or a lot of things, but they do have a lot of power. They do have the orbs that can do magnificent things. So there is an element there where, you know, at least there, all the miracles are for the people to see. You open up those orbs, things happen. That doesn't happen here, right? It is faith. There, it's a little bit different. You could almost feel that people there could come around to their point of view based on what they could show and provide. I think that the other piece that we were going down that trail before, too, about whether one side's right or one side's wrong, was with Sisko's speech to Jake. You know, he went so far back in history to Galileo. He didn't really bring it into modern times. And when I say that, it is when you talk about diversity and being inclusive, you would have thought coming to that space station and opening up a school that this would have been a subject that would have been very sensitive, and they would have discussed exactly how they should approach teaching it, because there weren't just humans in that class, there were aliens too. Yeah. And I think it's important for everybody in that class to understand the perspectives of everyone else in that class.
Well, I think that's where sort of the Wild West angle of DS9 comes in, and the fact that Keiko's not a teacher, she's a botanist who's opening a school in the station, and you don't actually have teachers there to set this stuff up and to plan the actual curriculum. If this were being taught on Earth and you had alien children in the classroom, and I mean Earth of the 24th century, there probably would be more care taken in how the subject matter is approached.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think going back to an earlier point about, you know, Keiko and Wynn representing, you know, the same, they're just opposites on the same, on opposite sides of an ideological spectrum. I would actually disagree with that. I think because of how I understand what they're doing with the episode, I understand that they're trying to present two arguments and obviously have Sisko come in and present a third way, a better way. But I think the way they were setting up the argument, I think for me, where the episode doesn't work is the sense that for me, Keiko's argument is I completely agree with it. Her argument on substance is not wrong. She says that when I'm teaching this scientific class, I'm teaching science, I'm going to teach about the facts that we know about the wormhole. Whether or not it is a belief held by the Bajorans is not a conversation I'm doing right now. It's a conversation I'm going to do if I'm teaching social studies, or even better yet, religious studies. We're talking about Bajoran faith. We're talking about faiths of the various Starfleet members that are there and other alien worlds too. But we're talking a physical sciences class, we're talking an astrophysical class, then we're talking completely about neutrinos and the wormhole effects and singularities. We're talking about that. And I think the episode was trying to say that they were on the same, they were just on the opposite sides, but they're the same. And I think for me, I don't think that necessarily is the lesson you want to take away from it, because there wasn't actually a compromise that was presented. I think that was very obvious. I think that the audience could have seen that compromise showing. It just was never offered. And that compromise was, we don't necessarily have to break up the school into Bajoran children and non-Bajoran children. Right. We can teach a religious studies class. We can teach the Bajoran faith in a different context. So we're going to not talk about the wormhole. We're going to talk about the Bajoran faith. But like Ken said, we're going to talk about the other faiths that are also present here. Atheism, agnosticism. Maybe there's a form of Earth religions that survive. Now we're going to talk about those too. But you also bring a good point too, Chris, where this is a Wild West environment. They haven't really thought this through yet. Maybe an Earth curriculum is more developed, but here they're just really kind of running by the seat of their pants, putting it together a school. So they're only encountering these problems now. But I think for me, that's the real compromise that Sisko should have said, was like, we're not going to have separate schools, but we're going to talk about the Bajoran faith. We're going to talk about it in a religious studies class separate from
what we see. It's Kira suggests that maybe we need to have separate schools, right, for Bajorans and for Federation children. I think it highlights that at this point, at the end of season one, the Bajorans still really don't want the Federation there at all. And Kira still doesn't really want the Federation there. And certainly Wynn doesn't want the Federation there. And this is part of Kira kind of slowly coming around to the reality of the Federation being there and more diversity and kind of breaking out of her Bajoran views a little bit, which she does nicely over the course of the series. Like you said, they could have science class and they can have religious studies class, or they can have science class and they can have Bajoran religious studies class. It could even be focused just on Bajoran religious studies, which, given the number of Bajoran children, the majority of those students are Bajorans, I believe. It makes sense to have a class about Bajoran religious studies where they can learn about the prophets. It's part of their culture. It's important for them to know these things. You don't have to teach it all rolled up into one class. And so, yes, the solution is rather obvious, but they can't go that route because otherwise the episode story doesn't work, right? The other thing, too, is it feels a bit like Sisko is maybe a little bit concerned about not pushing Keiko away. Like, if I were Sisko, I would do as you were suggesting and just say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a school. We're going to have science class. We're going to have math class. We're going to have language class. We're going to have Federation standard English language class. We're going to have Bajoran language class. We're going to have Bajoran religious studies class. If you don't want to teach it, Keiko, fine. We'll find some other teachers. You know, I can even ask the Federation Council to appoint teachers to the station, You know,
that put her in a good mood.
Yeah. Well, is Keiko ever in a good mood, Ken?
That's what I'm getting at. That was my point, yeah.
You know, there's sort of this balancing act, too, because Sisko knows that if he takes Keiko off, then Keiko's going to continue to push Miles to leave the station, and then he's going to lose his engineer. So even there, you know, there's all this management going on, even beyond the real issue of how the children are being taught.
What both you and Will said is straight on point, and I wish somebody could have written that so we know the direction they wound up going, because we don't. We don't know what was settled. Yeah. I think the school continues.
Yeah, the school continues.
The school continues.
Yeah. But we don't know what they said for the curriculum and how to get that balance back, but everybody on the station seems to get along, so I assume they found that compromise.
Well, I think, too, it has to do with Sisko's own journey. You know, in philosophy, we have the thesis of secularism, according to which science and technology on the one hand and religion on the other are inversely related. So we're really dealing with the conflict or concord between science and religion. And there are good arguments for both. You know, you think about it, Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, Pascal, Newton, Kelvin, these were all scientists who held a really deep Christian faith. So to them, good science began with the understanding that there was a divine creator. So they found concord between science and faith. On the other hand, there are lots of conflicts as well. So again, you've got Keiko on one side and you have Wynn on the other. You know, Keiko saying there's no room for faith in science, and Wynn saying, on the other side, that science is blasphemy. In the middle, you have Sisko, and that conversation he has with Jake, you know, Jake is, you know, saying all this stuff about the Bajoran religion, it's dumb. And Sisko says, no, it's not. And I think he's coming from the perspective of his own journey. He said, it's a matter of interpretation. That's a direct quote. He said, it's a matter of interpretation. So, you know, in this episode, when Kai Wynn and, or I should say Vedic Wynn and Keiko O'Brien first kind of lock horns, Keiko is teaching that there are verderons. You know, she's teaching that the wormhole is stable because it's made up of verderons, which are self-sustaining in nature. So it allows one to begin to understand how a shuttlewood impulse can safely fly through it. Wynn interjects on the other hand and says that the shuttle is guided by the hand of the prophets safely through the wormhole. So we have two points of view to basically explain the same thing. It's an Obi-Wan Kenobi thing. It just depends on your particular point of view.
One thing about faith, and Kira brings this up to Keiko, that some would say that teaching science is a kind of philosophy as well. And I'm very scientific myself, but if I really think about it, and if I'm being, as Matthew and I say on The Orb, sometimes intellectually honest about what we're talking about, you know, there is a lot of faith in science as well. If you think about something like the Higgs boson, which we recently discovered, and now we know it exists, for much of the 20th century, this is something that we thought existed, but we had no proof that it existed. But scientists continued to believe that the Higgs boson was real. And eventually, when our capabilities reached a certain point, we were able to find out that, yes, we're correct. It's real. But anyone who believed that that was true through all those decades, that's based on faith. I mean, it's based on information. You're extrapolating from knowledge that you already have about the makeup of matter. But you're also talking about a critical part of your theory, that your entire theory depends on this, and you don't know if it's real. And right now, dark matter is the same thing. We're now to the point where, yeah, we're pretty sure that dark matter is real. We still don't know what it is, but it's there. But that's a recent discovery. And for much of the 20th century, our theories, especially the late 20th century, our theories on why the universe is expanding and just the very nature of the universe relied on the existence of this dark matter to fill in the gaps in the equations, because we couldn't really explain what was going on. And we still don't know what it is, and we still don't know if we're truly correct, but we base everything that we teach about how nature works and the galaxy and the universe that we live in and why it exists is based in part on speculation. It's faith. We believe this stuff is real and we don't know. So in that respect, I mean, religion and science do have a lot in common. Mm-hmm. We're each choosing to believe things on faith. The difference for me and why I lean towards science is that I know that eventually we will be able to prove whether most things are right or wrong in our theories using actual evidence, where with religion, it's just based on faith.
Right. I think that's the important distinction, is because there's a hypothesis, right? And it's a hypothesis that is waiting for information to either confirm, to confirm, deny, or to modify that understanding. And I think that's the crucial distinction between the two, between faith and science. But you bring up a really good point too, Ken, is that the religion or the faith that we see on Bajor is vastly different than the faith that we have here, because it's a faith that's based upon observable phenomena. There's clearly entities within that wormhole. And that is completely a different story than faith here, because faith here is there's no observable entity that we know that's out there, that some will say it's a god, or we'll just say, oh, that's just a being that lives on that moon, right? That would be life. That would be huge here on Earth. We knew that there's an entity out there. One person, you know, scientists say they're aliens. Another say, you know, that's actually the manifestation of Judeo-Christian God, the Islamic God. That's completely different. So I think that's the interesting thing, is that even with the fact that there is observable phenomena, that there are definite entities there, their faith is still intact, says something about their faith, that says that even in the presence of this new information, that we can still change and interpret our beliefs to modify that. And I think that's the beauty of faith, but that's also why it's critically different than science, because, you know, science itself is going to change based off the information, based on your hypothesis. Faith can either be faith based off of complete faith that we have here on Earth, where you don't have any of that type of phenomenon that the wormhole has, or it could be the type of variation where we'll still have faith even if we have new information. And I think that's how the two can really coexist, is if they can respond to new information, if they can evolve and respond, then the two will be able to interact with each other. Because if things are static and unchanging, over time they're going to come outdated. And that's the reason why things need to evolve going forward, both faith and science.
It's also interesting with the Bajorans that a civilization as old as theirs is and as advanced as theirs is, because when we see them, they're coming out of the occupation. And also, they just seem to be a culture that's more in touch with nature and with spirituality. And they're not the super high-tech civilization that the Federation is. But if you look at something like the Baku in Insurrection, they're that same type of culture, right? Scientifically, I think the Bajorans have the capabilities of the Federation, and they've had access to these orbs and this wormhole for all of these centuries. And yet, the Federation comes in and very quickly analyzes what's going on, has a scientific explanation for it all that makes sense within what we know about the universe, we being the humans of the 24th century. But the Bajorans don't. So there must be a decision that they made, that they have faith that these orbs are spiritual objects, and that the aliens in the wormhole are gods, and they're not going to analyze this. They're not going to break it down, because otherwise they've had plenty of time to figure out what's actually going on from a scientific perspective.
Yeah, it's interesting, because they never really, they dance around it, but they never really explore in the series whether the realization, well, you mentioned the observable phenomenon, you know, does that undermine their religion or does it strengthen it? And they never really explore that. It's like you said, Chris, they refuse to kind of break that down, and they simply accept that, you know, as part of their core faith, their core spirituality.
Well, one other thing I want to touch on before we run out of time here is going all the way back to the beginning. Mike, you made the distinction between religion and spirituality. And then I also threw in faith. And we've talked a lot about faith just now. When you look at Kira and you look at Wynn and you look at, I'm trying to think, like Opaka maybe. When I look at Kira, I see someone who is a spiritual person, not a religious person. And when I look at Wynn on the surface, I see someone who's a religious person, not a spiritual person. But as we've discussed, I'm not sure that she's even really religious. I've never been convinced that Wynn believes in the prophets, like truly believes in the prophets. It's just a tool for her.
But wasn't she upset that she wasn't the emissary, though, later on in the series? She was upset. She mentioned that she was upset that they chose Sisko over her.
Yeah, right. But I still, it's not like, you know, she doesn't love the prophets. Like if someone's very, very religious and they really have very strong beliefs because there's some kind of love behind it. Does that make sense?
I get what you're saying.
You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying it very well, but I know what I think. And I don't feel that from her, right? I don't think that she truly believes in the prophets and that the prophets love the Bajoran people and that she is, you know, she calls people child a lot. But if someone truly believes that their purpose in life is to help other people, to further the goals of the God they believe in, to help others, to do good, right? I don't see that in her. Like she may be the religious leader of Bajor, but she's not actually doing the work of the prophets.
Yeah, that's a good point.
What I mean. And with Kira, I see someone who's very spiritual. And I think it's just really important that while I'm not, you know, religious myself and I'm not spiritual in that sense either, I can understand completely. And I was raised in the Baptist church in Alabama. Okay, so I grew up, and it's just over time I've just assimilated all the information around me, and I have my own belief about the world that I live in. And so I can completely understand people who are spiritual. And I think it can be a wonderful thing for people to be spiritual. And I think it's really a wonderful thing for Kira throughout the series, her spirituality. But there's definitely a distinction there between organized religion and the kind of people like Wynn who will use organized religion to further their own agenda versus just true spirituality, being in touch with nature or a higher being or whatever you believe.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the distinction with Wynn. She's very opportunistic. And I don't know if Disney were to ever, you know, much like they did with Maleficent, you know, they go back and they make a story about Kai Wynn, we'll discover that she's actually a character to be pitied. And, you know, she was wronged. Maybe the occupation stripped her of her genuine faith. And she, you know, she became this horrible, evil person that we can pity and feel sorry for. I don't know. But
I just jumped to Disneyland and seeing a big production, a parade, or maybe like a water thing at Disney Sea.
You can buy her hat
at the center. And you can buy her hat, yes, at the concessions.
You can buy it like as a popcorn holder. You could eat popcorn out of it.
Of course, you just need to be Jumja sticks on every corner.
You just have to be careful who you share your Jumja with.
That's true.
Yes.
I think that's I think that's a really interesting point, because that's actually one episode. That's one part of this episode where I wish we saw more development of, is how Kira evolves both in her understanding of how Bajor fits in with the Federation, their relationship, and obviously how that affects her relationship with Sisko, but also her relationship with faith and spirituality as well. And for me, I would have loved to have seen a scene where Keiko and Kira reconcile, because Kira's coming pretty strong at Keiko in Sisko's office initially. And obviously we know as the series goes on, they form a closer relationship because Kira carries Keiko's child down the road.
Yeah.
But we never see...
How about that?
We never see them, and we assume they do reconcile, but we never see them talking it through, saying, you know what, I respect your beliefs. There is a space for the two to reconcile, because she's coming very strong saying, you know what, I believe you're pushing your own ideology, you're pushing your own philosophy, and, you know, we can fill in the blanks, and they do reconcile. But it would have been really powerful that she reconciles not only with Sisko, but she also reconciles with Keiko too.
Yeah, you're right. We never get to see it, but on the same hand, Will, I feel like we did. We did see this reconciliation, this development. It's interesting because, you know, when we see Kira here, you're right. She's coming at Keiko very hard, very strong, and she is almost on the other side of that argument completely, but not quite. She's, you know, she's a step closer to the middle, say, than Kai Winn. And it's interesting because as we see her develop throughout the course of the next six seasons, we see her come a little bit more to the middle. So we see that reconciliation, but not directly. I agree. I would have liked to have, you know, have seen them kind of sit down and work that out. I think that's definitely relevant and something that I think needs to be modeled in media, because I think that there is a lot of that needs to happen in the world that we live in, and we just don't necessarily know how to do it.
Well, I think it speaks to Chris's point very well about being religious and being spiritual. A lot of spiritual people are very forgiving, and religious are too, but if you feel like you're being very passive and you're listening to people's other points of views and all that stuff and you're being respectful, but then somebody really challenges your faith, then the shields go up. And I think that's what's happened here. She's always kind of been in the background, and all of a sudden, you know, she feels a lot of strength in what Winn was saying, but it was more on how I think Keiko's approach. I mean, that person is very confrontational always, and it's one of those things I've seen many, many times, is a very spiritual person doesn't mind listening to other points of views and taking understanding until somebody says, oh, your position is wrong. That's what tripped it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, Kira says early on that she supports Vedic Wynn's bid to become the next Kai. You know, she's very much in her camp at the beginning of this episode. All that changes.
Be careful what you wish
all
for,
that, all that changes.
Be careful what you wish for.
And also, Winn does the ultimate thing here that's counter to Idik or any kind of cooperation when she just flips that switch on Sisko that I can see now that your goal is to destroy us. I mean, that's an enormous leap, right? To say that Sisko's goal, after he tried throughout this situation to find compromise, he's the most open-minded person that we see in this story. And she just flips on him. I can see now you're trying to destroy us. Your goal is just to destroy us all. But that's, again, what we see so often in our own world when you have these positions like this. Obviously, the other side's trying to destroy us. And so we have to fight back and destroy them.
Everything's extreme today.
Everything is extreme. Exactly. All right. Well, we are coming up on an hour. So let's do a rapid fire round here just to touch on a few other quick elements of the episode. I did want to ask you guys what you think about Vedic Barayal. Philip Anglim comes in to play Vedic Barayal. It's the first time we see him. He makes 8 total appearances in DS9. It feels like more than that, but he is there. Matthew and I have come to call him Dirty Vedic because of his relationship with Kira down the road and the way that Anglim plays the character. Sometimes I feel down the road that his delivery of the material turns it into something very different than what the writers intended it to be. Here, I don't feel quite so much that way, but Will, what do you think about Barayal's debut appearance?
Right. I like Barayal. I think a lot of fans give Barayal a hard time. I see where they're coming from. But I think this is an episode where I think he's one of his strongest performances. This is his debut episode. And I think he's, especially in that scene on Bajor when Sisko seeks him out, he is shown to be a very understanding, much more moderate, but he's also very canny too. He's all like, if I help you now, I can't help you later. It's so political, but it's so smart because that's how the religion is being portrayed. It is religion, but it's also another arena for politicians as religious leaders to be politicians, right? It's so clever, but it's also, I think, an important role for Beryl to be in this episode because it shows the fact that religion is not necessarily the issue here. It's how you're going to use your religion, how you use it as a means to an end or not as a means to an end. And it shows that Beryl is very eminently reasonable and that this is something that is really not necessarily a religion versus rationalism, religion versus science thing, but it's really about something beyond that.
Yeah, of his 8 appearances, I think this is definitely his best. He's got a great line in that conversation with Sisko. He says, "We're all good enough to muster up enough fear to justify whatever we want to do." And I think that line really explains a lot about the motives behind what Vedic Wynn is doing here. He doesn't come across quite as creepy. I still feel that he's... I'm not sure. He's a little HAL 9000-ish, you know. Hey, Dave.
That's a really good analogy.
I'm just waiting for him to say, "No, Sisko, don't shut me down." I don't know if it's the way he's written. I think it's probably more the way Philip Anglim plays Vedic Beryl. But of the 8 appearances, I think this is definitely his strongest.
Yeah, he's very grounded in this, and that's what I liked about him. He could very quickly step back, look at the whole situation, understand timing, understand the circumstance. It wasn't to what Sisko wanted it at all, but he was very upfront about it. And so what I like about him in general is that he can step back, see both sides, but understand there's a game being played, and he had to be careful, although he walked right into the trap.
I love the way, though, Sisko is able to cut through the religious baloney and say, that sounds like the prophets teach you politics as well, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's a great line.
Cuts through that, you know? I love it.
Definitely. Let's talk about Wynn just a little bit more. We've already talked all about her character, but fans always say, and if you mention Wynn online in a discussion, people will come out and go, "I hate Wynn. I hate Wynn." Well, why do you hate Wynn? You hate Wynn because this is some of the best casting in Star Trek. One of the best choices. Louise Fletcher plays Wynn so well that you hate that character because the performance is just so spot on. That's my feeling on it. How about you, Will?
I absolutely agree. And I think for me growing up, I didn't appreciate the spiritual storyline, and I hear that so much on online discussion boards, like, "Oh, DS9 was great except for all that Bajoran religion stuff, all that stuff, it's nonsense." And for me, that is totally missing the point of the show. It is an integral part of the show. And of course, Kai Wynn, Vedic Wynn, is supposed to be unlikable because that's the role she's supposed to play, and she plays it so well, and Louise Fletcher does a fantastic job, a superlative job playing that. And I think you only appreciate it if you really go into it with the right eyes. For me, I had to be older for me to really understand and appreciate it, because otherwise it is just like any other show. That's the whole point of what makes DS9 DS9, is it's telling this story, this spiritual story. And if you don't get that, then, I mean, it's just all about the space battles, I guess, which is kind of a superficial analysis of it. But for me, I've only grown to appreciate her more and more, even later on with the Paul Rates and what have you. Even with that storyline, I think it still really is an essential part of the DS9 mythos. You have to have someone like Wynn.
Yeah, the fact that I want to understand what happened to her, because, again, I think there's a story there to be told. She just didn't wake up one day and decide to use her position to grab power. There's a story there. I think that her belief is genuine. Her faith is not. And again, let's make that distinction. Casting, Louise Fletcher, Oscar Award winner for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Vedic Ratchet, you know. she is such a strong character actor. And the fact that she is so hated, I think, is honestly a compliment to the quality of the performance that she gave. Because I've seen her in interviews, and I've heard other actors who have worked with her talk about what a genuinely sweet and generous person she is, so far removed from this character, and for that matter, Nurse Ratched. Tremendous casting there.
She's perfect for that role, absolutely perfect. And I think about other people that I've met in my life that have that same condescending, smiling approach to things, and you just go, this is a bad cat. And yeah, she is just that perfectly. She does a great job with it. And right from the beginning, even though I was saying she was compromising, I knew it was an act, but you just see that she just seethes with a very bad spirit about her. I don't know, Mike, if I agree that something changed or if she was, you know, like Palpatine's wife, if he was to have one, just bad from the beginning. You know, sometimes people are just bad and it doesn't make sense, but I don't know. I can't even picture her being a kind and generous person who fell into the bad side or became a corrupt politician that was using religion as a lever for power. She just, it's perfect, perfect role. You got to love to hate her.
Palpatine and Wynn, galactic power couple.
That is the episode title.
There you go.
That is the episode title.
I think her theme music should have been Bad to the Bone.
Yeah.
That's good.
All right. Well, we have gone way past an hour, so let's go ahead and wrap up here with final thoughts and our rating. Mike, how about you?
Yeah, I'll say it again. This episode does a very good job of exploring this contrast between science and religion. And again, Star Trek does a good job raising these questions, not always a very good job answering them. And once again, we're left with probably more questions at the end of this episode than we started out with. But nevertheless, we kind of glossed over the great murder mystery that's going on in this and the manipulation of Neela, the murder of Ensign Aquino. So there's a really great story, kind of B-plot going on here, trying to solve this murder and, you know, get to the bottom of, you know, what's going on there in the midst of this very epic battle between science and religion. One thing we didn't bring up as well is the fact that it seems to me like the Bajoran religion somehow might be connected to Han Solo in the Bajoran temple. On the station, I noticed that there are what looks to be two Han Solos encased in carbonite. if you go back and look at the episode, so I'm thinking somehow Han Solo plays into the Bajoran religion. But besides that, really, just a really great line when Sisko talks about, he said, some damn good fights. He said, and we always came away with a better understanding and appreciation for one another. And again, I think that's really the spirit of Star Trek. I those are my final thoughts. I give this 8 out of 10 Jumja sticks.
All right.
Don't eat all.
I knew the first
person really
to give
sweet.
A rating was going to go for the Jumja stick.
That's true.
I had a backup just in case I wasn't first.
How about you, Will?
So I really like this episode, even though there are areas in which I think the episode could have been stronger. I think areas in which it could have been stronger is not necessarily portraying Keiko as the philosophical opposite of Wynn. I think having a little more nuance in the compromise having more nuance in presenting a compromise that both sides could live with. But I understand the reason why they wanted to do what they wanted to do was they wanted to tell a larger story about science and religion, the role of faith. And I like the fact that that is an important piece of the mythos. The fact that we're still talking about this episode 25 plus years later shows that this is an important piece of Star Trek. This is what Star Trek is best at. It should be doing stuff like this episode. So it teaches us so many lessons that are relevant now in terms of living in a pluralistic society. How can you reconcile between religion, different types of interpretation, extremism, areas of morality, areas of ethics and politics, and how all of that plays into your interpretation of religion and faith and of science? And it's arguably even more relevant now. So even though, you know, there are issues with how I feel the episode could have been stronger overall, I think still this is what Star Trek should be about. It's why I love Star Trek, so I love Deep Space Nine. So for me, I'm going to give this 9 out of 10 Sydney Opera House hats that Kai Winn wears. So
awesome.
I love this episode.
How about you, Ken?
Well, I thought it was a gutsy episode, but it could have been more gutsy, as we were talking about. I agree with both the points that Mike and Will are given as far as it could have been stretched more. As far as the murder mystery, I thought the ending was, well, it was just okay. It could have been better. I think I'd like to see somebody put together a YouTube video where they show Kirk's leap to the Klingon Chancellor and rescuing her versus Sisko. Because Sisko's leap into the crowd was choppy at best. I mean, they were both right. Flying. I think they both had a good amount of air underneath them. But I'd like to see, you know, based on the age, the distance, and all that other stuff, I think Kirk would have won on that contest.
I think that maybe Sisko needed some help. I think when he was leaping, he yeah. should have said, "Help me!" as he was leaping. That would have tied
maybe
it all
we
in
could,
well.
And thinking of that, too, how about Vader's no versus his no? They're about the same length, slow motion. I mean, you could kind of play with it a little bit.
Well, Ken is giving everyone a YouTube project right here.
Yeah, well, I'm just trying to bring it down a little because it was a very intense episode and there was a lot of controversial subjects. Like, would you say, when? That's what Star Trek does best. It makes people talk. It makes you think. It makes you look internally at how you view things, and when you yeah. have these types of podcasts and conversations, it just brings it to a whole new level, I think, of just better scale, better quality. So that's where I would leave it. I had a 4 out of 5 scale, and I was only going with the gold, plus platinum, because, Mike, you stole mine. So anyway, we move on.
Okay. You can have Verderon particles.
Thanks. You want to spell that for me?
That's right. Totally a real scientific element. That's totally not made up at all.
That's right. Have faith, Will.
Exactly.
Totally real. We will eventually discover Verderon particles. Well, you guys have covered most everything. I would say one thing that I love about this episode is, well, first, I love its position in the franchise in that it's at the end of the first season of DS9. So we're coming out of TNG, and we've worked through some TNG-like stories on DS9, but by making religion a central theme in the series, DS9 really took a different path than Star Trek had in the past. And having it at the end of Season 1 here, it gave viewers enough time to acclimate to Deep Space Nine and kind of get used to the idea that the religion was there without getting into this very controversial topic right off the bat in the series. But it's still early in the series, so it serves its purpose of shaping where things are going to go. The other thing that I love about it is that in true Deep Space Nine fashion, it presents two sides of the argument, but it never tells you as the viewer which one's right and which one's wrong. And I think that's really important because at the very, very beginning of our discussion today, I said that Gene Roddenberry's vision for Star Trek isn't always clear in the original series, because while I believe that this is Gene Roddenberry's vision, there are many angles and none are necessarily right or wrong. We have to learn how to embrace them all and try to work together. In reality, in the original series, we see Kirk flying in to different planets and setting people straight. This is how you're supposed to do it. You shouldn't mm-hmm. fight a war against each other with computers. It's bad. I'm going to blow up all your computers and then leave you to figure out how to deal with it, right? It's that kind of attitude. And also in TNG, I think we also get the, here's the right way to do things. Here's what you should think. And DS9 got rid of that and said, here are all the different ways that you might think, and we're going to present both sides to you, and then we're going to leave it up to you to figure out what is right and what's wrong. And so I think you can watch all of Deep Space Nine and you can come away from watching the series and, of course, this episode with a completely different take on what the story is about. And so I really appreciate that even early on here, they've done that and they did it with a, a very controversial and very timeless debate between science and religion. And on The Orb, we've actually covered this, but we covered it not as a standalone episode. We covered it as science versus religion on Bajor. So if you go back to The Orb 10, which is a long time ago, The Orb episode 10 called A Matter of Interpretation, you can hear more discussion on this, some of the same topics that we touched on today, and then some different points as well. And I think we may have talked about Beryl a little bit more in that episode. So anyway, I really love this one. I think that it is a turning point for the series, and I'm going to give it 9 ear grabs, sometimes unwanted ear grabs.
Unwanted ear grabs.
I love that Sisko throws in to Beryl that he will have the Federation's support in eliminating the ear grabbing. It's kind of a funny moment. All right. Well, Mike and Ken, thanks so much for joining us today. Before we go, Ken, tell everyone where they can find you around the interwebs.
Well, for me, it is really the Babel Conference. That's where I play on Facebook. Don't have a Twitter account at this point, but that's where I hope to catch up with people. Or if you want to reach me through just regular email, you can tap me on the messenger for Facebook and I'll send it out.
Awesome. And how about you, Mike?
Of course, I'm associate producer of Warp 5, also co-host of Metatrex with Zachary Frühling on the interwebs, Facebook, the Babel Conference, also Twitter. My username is @cmichael1701.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks again for the conversation today, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was a great discussion about In the Hands of the Prophets and Deep Space Nine, and I think the really strong end to season one. So I really enjoyed that conversation we had with Mike and Ken.
Yeah, it was great. It's such a big episode. There's so much to talk about because, as Mike pointed out at the end there, we really didn't talk about the mystery that was going on because we're very focused on the science versus religion and Keiko versus Wynn and how Sisko's trying to mediate. So I do encourage everyone to go listen to the Orb 10 where we have another discussion about this. It's a good supplemental to this. And I was also thinking, Will, that maybe Matthew and I should go back and do an episode on the mystery part of this episode alone.
You were going to say Jumja Sticks, an entire episode on how do they make them? What are they?
Yeah, we should. We should. Well, you know, they come from the Jumja tree. They're a very great source of vitamin C, Will.
You already have the beginning of an episode right there, Chris. I mean, it writes itself.
And then we can use theme music. We can have vitamin C, the singer, singing about Jumja Sticks. She's not doing anything these days, right? Maybe we could commission her to do a song for us.
I mean, she really hasn't done anything since that song Graduation anyway, so I might as well just bring her back for Deep Space Nine.
That's right. All right. Well, we told you between news and the feature about all the great shows we have here on the network, so I do encourage everyone to go check out other things that we're talking about. And if you'd like to share your feedback on today's show, there are many ways for you to get in touch with us. You can find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. We also have our page on Facebook, facebook.com/TrekFM. You can go to our website and use the contact form, trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and choose the ready room, and that'll come to us by email. And you can send us a voicemail at speakpipe.com/trekfm. Now, the best place to really get into a discussion about In the Hands of the Prophets or anything we talk about here is the Babel Conference on Facebook. That's our closed listeners discussion group. Will, tell everyone a little bit about that.
Sure. So, like Chris said, it's our dedicated Facebook listeners group, and it's a community where we discuss all things Trek, but also all things non-Trek because of 602, and we discuss all things geek, and it's just a really great community for in-depth conversations that's respectful and smart and witty, but also at the same time, we also have a really fun time in there. We have a really great time with everyone there, and I've really made some great friends, and it's just a really great watering hole for the types of conversations that we have on air. So it's really a continuation of that. So we really welcome anyone who loves Trek FM to kind of join us in the Babel Conference.
Definitely. And the biggest thing about it is that we have, I don't know how many people now, 850 to 900 people in there, but we are able to have respectful discussions like we had on the show today, even about controversial topics, which is something that's just so rare online. And I'm really proud of everyone in the group for continuing the spirit of what we try to establish here on the network on our shows in an online discussion forum. So the way you get there is in Facebook, type B-A-B-E-L into the search field, and it'll come right up, the Babel Conference. It is a closed group, so you do need to click join, and then we'll let you in, and we hope that you'll join us there. Speaking of contact, Will, and the contact form on our website, we recently received a message from listener Todd Waters in Northern California. He says, in fact, he lives in the suburbs of Starfleet Academy.
Wow.
So
he takes a shuttle to work every day, one of those shuttle trams.
That would be awesome, right? So Todd says, I wanted to submit an idea for the Ready Room. Great episodes away from the ships. Shows like TNG, Lessons, TOS, The City on the Edge of Forever, Enterprise, Carbon Creek, DS9, The Visitor, Voyager, Living Witness, or TNG, Darmok. They're all great fan favorites, and they also take place away from the ship or space station. I think a show on why these stand out with fans would be interesting. Wanted to share the thought. All right, Todd, thanks so much for that suggestion. The thing about the Ready Room is the format of this show is we just rotate through the series and we cover an episode. Occasionally we do a special show, but it's usually because of something like Leonard Nimoy's passing or something like this. So I'm not sure that this would be a good topic for the Ready Room, but it did make me think that this could be a great idea for doing a crossover with our series shows, which is something that we have done once or twice in the past, but could be fun to do more often. So, Will, maybe we could take this idea of Todd's here, and maybe we could have Standard Orbit, Earl Grey, The Orb, To the Journey, and Warp 5, our five series shows, get together for like a week where we all cover this topic. And it could be like a week away from the ship, something like that. What do you think?
I really like it. We can call it a week away at Star Trek camp,
okay.
Away from the ship. And we just talk about, and obviously we can bookend it with Final Frontier when they're literally camping. They're literally on Earth camping away from the ship. I think it's a really smart idea because after a while, you know, we cover, there's a lot of Star Trek, obviously, but after a while, you know, we're looking for new angles, and that's a very sharp angle to kind of tackle, but also allow crossover, like you say, Chris, with other shows and see what similarities are there. What are there commonalities which make these mm-hmm. episodes stand out? And I think that's a really good idea. And it seems that the listeners really like our crossover shows when we have Earl Grey, you know, facing off against Standard Orbit on Bridgemates or To the Journey. It's a lot of fun. So that's really an idea worth exploring.
Yeah, definitely. So I think we'll look into that, Todd. So thanks so much for the suggestion and for listening to the show and really appreciate your feedback there. We got one more message here. This was not specifically to the Ready Room, but it was just to the network. But I'll get your thoughts on this one as well, Will. This is from Rory Johnston, who is on Earth in the UK. And Rory...
She's on Earth.
She's on Earth, yes. And Rory had a suggestion. Just an idea for a show. With the current vacuum in news about the next incarnation of Star Trek, would it be useful to review Encounter at Farpoint, Emissary, The Caretaker, and Broken Bow, but perhaps not in the way you did before? These were each some of the greatest episodes of their respective shows, and also just their first attempts, their pilots. Each of these had some great moments that helped to capture a new audience and set up characters for the coming years. Which are the types of scenes in these shows that you would like to see reimagined in the next incarnation of Trek? Or, if you were writing the next pilot, what parts of these episodes would you want to bottle, and which would you rather bin? All right, so... Interesting idea here. So a re-examination of the pilots of each series, at least the modern series, with a look ahead of reimagining those for a new show. I'm not sure exactly how we would frame this, but I think it's an interesting idea. What do you think?
I think it's a very interesting idea. I think because you can look at it from a production perspective, you can look at it from a lot of that, how a show was debuted, how it was received, you know, the Nielsen ratings, the critic ratings, how it was received by fans at the time, and then how was it received from fans in subsequent years, because hindsight can be 2020, hindsight can be more harsh it can be more forgiving as time goes on. But also at the same time, it's really interesting because the new Star Trek series has a history to look back on. So these series, these pilots are something that fans will remember. So in a way, does the history of these pilots, do they serve as an impediment or do they serve as something as a launching pad for the new series? That's a really good question. Like, is the new Star Trek series going to be hurt because there've been five different pilots that have come before this? What are we going to expect? What's going to be different? So I think that's a really unique take on it. It's really interesting. Like, what can they do that they haven't done before? And something that can still like meet everyone's expectations, exceed them, do something fresh. And in a lot of ways, it can be challenging, it can be confining, but could also be something that really reshuffles the deck in a creative way. So I think it's a really good idea.
Yeah. And you're lucky, Rory, that Will is the content manager for the network here right now. So Will, I'm going to pass this to you to figure out how we might turn this idea into some episodes.
Got it. All we are going to do the entire episode in flashback because I feel like that's the new thing in like TV shows is like really big on flashbacks. I want to say the new Star Trek series is going to be like very big on like huge segments of like backstory, flashback. That's going to be a thing.
I think that in the middle of the storyline on the new series, they're going to interview the different crew members.
Oh,
about
mean
what's
like
going
almost
on,
like an,
you know,
like an office type
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Really? Wow. Oh, I didn't think about that.
I'm just kidding. I don't think they're going to do that.
Oh, you're totally kidding. I thought you were totally serious. Like
it would be interesting, man. Though, right? I was watching The Muppets, and the latest episode, twice Kermit is talking to someone, and then he finally asks them, well, what do you think? And they're like, oh, wait, were you talking to me? I thought you were doing one of those interview things.
It's so good. It's so meta. I feel like that's a thing now. It's all like... That's where sitcoms are going. Right? It's so meta and so interview. It's so fourth wall type stuff.
All right. So Rory, thank you also for your message here. Really appreciate the feedback. And for everyone else, again, trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show. Choose a ready room. That'll come to me. Or Twitter, trekfm, facebook.com/trekfm, or the Babel Conference. Or speakpipe.com/trekfm are all the ways that you can get in touch with us. All right. So, Will, if people want to get in touch with you, where should they go?
Sure. You can reach me on Twitter at BoomerNiner, which is a very fitting Twitter handle that I just adopted. My love of Enterprise and Deep Space Nine. And you also find me, of course, in the Babel Conference, our dedicated listeners Facebook group. And, of course, you can find me on Warp 5 every week as the co-host with Norman Lau. And, you know, I just love to hear your thoughts either on Twitter or in the Babel Conference. Drop me a line and love to chat.
You do know that Boomer Niner is now a ringtone in Patron Zone, right?
I can die a happy man, Chris. I feel like that is the epitaph on my photon torpedo tube when I'm shot out. It says I was a Trek FM ringtone.
I guess that was from the last Ready Room that you and Norm were on. At the same time, right? And you did Boomer Niner, and then Norm and I both yelled Boomer Niner, and I turned it into a ringtone. So there you go.
Yes.
You're famous. So I mentioned Patron Zone. So what is Patron Zone? Well, Patron Zone is a special website that we have that is just for those who support the network through Patreon. We're a listener-supported network, and we do need your help to keep the shows coming every day of the week. So if you go to patreon.com/trekfm, you can find out how you can support us on a month-to-month basis. And we have many, many people who are doing that. We really thank everyone for their support. And one of the perks from the $5 per month level and up is access to patron.zone. That's the URL. And it's our patron zone where we do early releases of shows. We do other special content. We have wallpapers and avatars and ringtones and all sorts of things there. All the perks are available all the time to you through patron.zone if you are a supporter of the network through Patreon. So please go check it out. Patreon.com/TrekFM is the URL, and you can find out everything there on how you can help us keep Star Trek discussion going. And also another thing that you can get through Patreon is the ability to get involved in the network as an associate producer. And I'd like to thank our associate producers for The Ready Room, Zachary Frühling, who is Mike Morrison's co-host on Metatrex, as well as Renee Roberts, who has been a huge supporter of the network for years and years now. And we really thank them both for their support. You can find Renee on Twitter. Her username is Mares_1701. And you can find Zachary on Twitter. His username is just his name, Zachary Frühling, Frühling. And again, that's a way to become involved in the network. And in fact, a lot of our associate producers have appeared on the shows that they support, like Mike on Warp 5 and Zachary here on The Ready Room. And then Zachary and Mike actually formed their own show, Metatrex, now. And they originally hooked up with us through Patreon. So go check that out. And if you'd like to find me, last thing here, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. That's also my name on Facebook and pretty much everywhere. You can find me in the Babel Conference talking Star Trek all the time with all of our listeners. You can find me here on the network doing The Orb, which I mentioned many times today with Matthew Rushing. That's our show dedicated exclusively to Deep Space Nine. I also do our short news show called Hyperchannel from time to time, as well as Continuing Mission, which is about fan films and independent productions. If you'd like to read my writing on Star Trek, you can find that on the official website at StarTrek.com. I have a column there called Trekspectives. And also, I do a non-Trek podcast, believe it or not. So if you're just interested in hearing me talk for some reason, and you want to hear me talk about Japan and language and interview various people, and it's just non-Trek stuff. In fact, yesterday, actually, I just recorded an interview with Mark Osborne, who's the director of The Little Prince, which is opening in Japan today, actually, and in the States next spring. But he also directed Kung Fu Panda and some other films like that. That's actually going to be in that podcast. So it's not just about Japan. It's also about entertainment. And that's called Metropolis On Air. And you can find it by searching iTunes and other places for Metropolis On Air, if you're interested in hearing me ramble on about other things not related to Star Trek. All right, Will. Well, I'm going to let you go. I'm going to wander back down and see if I can find some of those EJ7 interlocks, because I've been having trouble getting the pantry in my kitchen to close this weekend, and I think that's just the tool I need.
Well, I think it's time to stick a Jumja stick in it, Chris, because the ready room is done.